The sermon came about because one of the mothers of young children in our church asked for it. That may sound odd, but it's the first time in 20 years anyone has ever asked for a Mother's Day sermon. At her suggestion, I arranged for a series of three lunches with a total of 12 live mothers from our church. Mothers of young children. They assigned me books. I read one long book that I was assigned and a 40-page chapter from another book. Both the books and the live women brought up almost exactly the same subjects. Much of it was new to me, and some of it was almost painful to hear and to read. Some was surprising. The two books were Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety by Judith Warner, and Misconceptions by Naomi Wolf, in which I read just the 40-page chapter called Calling It Fair. With all this homework and three lunches and emails, my sample still of live mothers and book mothers is very limited. It's only dealing with women married to men, even though there are many more kinds of motherhood here and all over America. So this is a small start on a big and important subject, and these are all mothers of young children. So it may not relate exactly to women who raised their children in the 70s. It'll be interesting to hear if it does. One of the most positive things in all the discussions was that there was almost no man bashing. These women were grateful for their husbands' love and care and help. Several of them mentioned the joy of marrying men who were sympathetic to feminist aims and who had grown up in the same culture that they had, and they all spoke of them as good fathers. One woman who couldn't attend the lunch sent her comments by email, and they were poetic. Having my first child, she wrote, filled me with a love I had never even imagined before, and it made me big enough to feel all that love. It opened me up to the whole world, and that big love is still with me. It didn't disappear with the bottles and diapers. Many years later, it dawned on me that my own mother must feel that same love for me. Wow. I still find comfort in this revelation. I don't think you have to have kids to get this big love. I'd like to think I would have gotten there on my own. But I do think having kids got me there a lot sooner. While all the mothers, live mothers and book mothers, shared this love for their children, few expressed it quite so poetically. These are all women born in the 1960s and 70s. Some of them said one of the great things about growing up in the age of women's rights with men who were sympathetic to the goals of feminism was that when they married, they felt that they were marrying their best friends. It was an egalitarian marriage where they were able to negotiate in a wider range of areas, both personal and professional, than their mothers or grandmothers had been able to do. They developed a sense of self, both in school and their careers, that had an assertive or aggressive or competent and self-confident edge that few generations of women before them in America have been able to develop so openly. Then the baby came and everything changed. One study says that one of the most likely times for a marriage to fall apart is following the birth of the first baby, when almost 70% of couples report a decrease in marital happiness. One woman said she could remember reading in all those books how some mothers in the first 6 weeks never got dressed and forgot to eat. She wondered what kind of women these were. How could anyone forget to eat, not find the time to take a shower, get dressed? It sounded as if these were some slovenly, preposterous women. Then, she said, I had my first child. I was completely overwhelmed by it, and I didn't find time to eat or take a shower or get dressed. Another said, I always imagined that I would earn a graduate degree in early childhood education and begin teaching college or open my own daycare after having my own family. In reality, I quit working a few months before my daughter was born, and I've never re-entered the workforce on a full-time basis since then. I found that earning enough to pay for daycare was impossible. I have a story from 90 years ago about this that this reminded me of so much. When my grandparents married, my grandmother Grace Davidson married my grandfather Clement Lohr, which will give you some idea where my name came from. They met in college, both graduated from the University of Iowa around 1907 or 8. Very unusual for women to be graduating from college in 1908. All reports from her siblings, who were my great aunts and uncles, indicated that while they were both very nice people, she was clearly the brighter and more ambitious and more aggressive of the two. He became a Presbyterian minister, she became a mother, and after the birth of her fourth child of 7, she had a nervous breakdown and spent a couple months in what they called a sanitarium at the time. One of my half-sisters, who was named after her, did research into this some decades later and found that what Grace had written was that with the birth of the fourth child, she realized all her dreams of a career, of an achievement, of using any of the intellect that she brought to college, all her dreams were dead. So it's not a brand new story, but it is a story still happening. Author Naomi Wolf put it this way: the baby's arrival acted as a crack, then a fissure, then an earthquake that wrenched open the shiny patina of egalitarianism in the marriages of virtually every couple I knew. When the husband of one of Naomi Wolf's friends started taking Fridays off to help with the baby, the women all celebrated him as a demigod. To the other husbands, she began to realize, the fact that he could afford to take Fridays off meant his job wasn't that important. To the men, and these were the egalitarian pro-feminist men, he was a loser. The mothers all said it was a 24/7 job that at times just seemed overwhelming. They had no time for themselves. They lost themselves, and they lost that self that they'd spent so many years developing in the atmosphere of women's liberation and women's rights. When they were nursing an average of every 2 hours, it made them sleep deprived. They had no idea it would be this time consuming. I thought of this last weekend while I was driving through New Hampshire, and I was following a black SUV with a personalized license plate that said Kid Limo and a single bumper sticker that read, "Every mother is a working mother." Maybe it's not surprising, though it surprised me, to find that Mother's Little Helpers, by a few years ago, had become drugs, especially methamphetamine or crystal meth, which in 2002 was named the drug of choice for supermoms. Nobody can really do it alone. One woman said an image that kept coming into her mind was of a teapot tipped over with the last drop hanging from its tip. Tip me over and pour me out. Other times she imagined herself to be a little generator with another tiny appliance plugged into her, sucking energy, and yet her own power source had been disconnected. Both in the books and in the three lunches, women said they had little hands all over their body all day, and by night they found they were all touched out and often just wanted their body left alone. Being touched related to being needed, said one, and I was giving all I had to give to the baby. There was nothing left for Daddy. All of this is often, this is an understatement that's coming, all of this is often a very unpleasant surprise for their husbands. It redefined sexiness in unexpected ways. For instance, one sociological study I read found that women find men's willingness to do their share of the housework erotic. Those are all high-pitched laughs. You know what I'm saying? When I mentioned this at one of our lunches, the response was, "You bet. You want some loving? Do the dishes. Do the dishes, put away the clothes I washed, and I'll be all over you." Where do we sign? There's a liberated man with an agenda. For most men, this is a whole new and strange definition of foreplay. When I asked our mothers what kind of gifts they wanted for Mother's Day, the question didn't get an immediate response. And then one woman said, "Time. 8 hours alone. Even 4 hours alone. Time." Another said the greatest gift she received in the first year after the birth of her child came from an older woman friend who gave her permission to stop breastfeeding and use formula. Virtually every woman at the lunches nodded in understanding with this. For another woman, it was a gift she gave herself, sort of almost secretly, that when she returned to work part-time, she'd wear her low-heeled mommy shoes out to the car, but in the car she had high heels. And she would put on her high heels because they made her feel more feminine and more professional, and she would spend the day being the feminine and professional woman that recognized that self she had spent so many years trying to create. Then on the way home, she'd change shoes and go be mommy again. And you can't talk about mothering today without mentioning the word guilt. All the women, live mothers and book mothers, spoke of feeling guilty, spoke of competitive mothering, of being judged by other mothers, by other women, sometimes by total strangers. They were expected to be perfect, and they often felt that they were struggling just to be adequate. And some of the books on child rearing just add to the guilt without empowering the mothers. If there are horrible books out on religion, there are horrible books out on child rearing too. T. Barry Brazelton, one of the country's leading authorities on how to care for infants over the last 3 or 4 decades, wrote of mothers in the highlands of Mexico who breastfed up to 70 to 90 times a day, and he added, "That's being there for the baby." But there's more. Because none of this, he pointed out, none of the going and cooing and crawling and bonding and talking and singing and popsicle stick gluing, none of this would work. None of this would mean a thing, he and others wrote, if it was not done with absolute joy, with great delight and pleasure, at each and every moment in the day. Is it any wonder that 70% of mothers surveyed in 2000 said they found motherhood incredibly stressful? It wasn't always like this. In fact, never before in America, not even in the much maligned 1950s, has motherhood been conceived in this totalizing, self-annihilating, utterly ridiculous way. The experts of the 1960s held that mothers should set limits both on their children's behavior and on their own level of maternal enmeshment for the psychological health of both. The experts in the 70s agreed that unhappy mothers produced unhappy children. It's like the instructions in airplanes. If the oxygen masks fall, put your own on first, then help someone else. The majority opinion in the 1970s was that the key to maternal self-fulfillment was work outside the home. Some experts even opined that working mothers were better mothers than stay-at-home moms. Child psychiatrist Bruno Bettelheim, for one, said that the enforced selflessness of stay-at-home motherhood was ill-suited for educated women or their children. That's 30 years ago. In the 1970s and 80s, many mainstream baby boomer women prided themselves on breaking with the sacrificial roles that they saw their own mothers having played. The 1980s were about self-actualizing, self-fulfilled motherhood. By 1986, 20 years ago, a majority of all women with children under age 3 were in the workforce. By the mid-1980s, mainstream women's magazines were citing studies showing that working moms were happier, healthier, and less stressed than non-working mothers. And then somehow everything changed. Suddenly, as the 1980s turned into the 1990s, the word guilt was everywhere in the magazine stories on motherhood. It was guilt about working, guilt about not being there enough for the children. Working mothers were no longer celebrated as heroines. They were called villains, selfish, and unnatural. I'm not exaggerating. One woman writing in a 1994 book even compared leaving a baby in daycare center to the trauma of a child whose mother had died. Though leaving children in a daycare center is a lot more expensive than most couples can afford, and getting high-quality child care workers is even harder. And that's because the U.S. is the only industrialized country without a national maternity benefit plan, without paid leave, and without a coherent daycare policy. The only one. The Family Leave Act we have lets women take off 3 months, but without pay. Not many families can afford to do that. You can't talk about the pressures on parents without talking about the anti-life priorities of our economy. Last week, USA Today, I don't read these, but when I'm in airports, I'll read the top half of the front page. So on the top half of the front page of USA Today, a week ago Saturday, there was an article called "Till Debt Do Us Part," about how the tensions created by debt may be the biggest single reason many marriages end. And yesterday's New York Times had a story that talked about a 38% increase nationally in home foreclosures in the first quarter of this year over the same period in 2005. Florida had the second largest number of foreclosures in the nation during that period, with over 29,000, behind Texas, which had over 40,000. We're number one. Once again, to repeat a quote we can't hear often enough, the U.S. is the only industrialized country without national maternity benefits, paid leave, or a coherent daycare policy. Maybe you think we've just never cared about families, or that figuring out how to support them is just too hard or too expensive. But in fact, we did all this during World War II. We did it very quickly, and we did it very well, and almost no one remembers it. In order to help women join the workforce in World War II, the government provided services from shopping to laundry, cleaning facilities, a catering kitchen, and child care centers in each neighborhood, clustered as close together as possible, and supplemented by family health and recreation facilities. There was even a mending service for the kids' torn clothing. And on the way home, the tired mother could pick up a nourishing hot meal, prepared and packed for her at the center to bring home along with her children. After the war, the men needed their jobs back, and this elaborate, smoothly operating, and highly successful solution to the work-family problem was simply shut down. Not even a memory remained in most history books to give women a blueprint with which to agitate for a comparable solution, nor to remind all of us that such a thing really could be done, and very well. But we don't have to wait 60 years to forget important facts. The current, often hysterical crop of child-rearing gurus seem to have forgotten that there's no proof that children suffered in the past because their mothers put them in playpens. There's no proof that children suffer today because their mothers work. None of the studies conducted on the children of working mothers in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s have ever shown that a mother's work outside of home per se has any impact upon her child's well-being. The quality of care a child receives while the mother's away, on the other hand, has a major impact, but that's a whole other story. Studies have never shown that total immersion in motherhood makes mothers happy or does their children much good. On the contrary, studies have shown that mothers who are able to make a life for themselves tend to be happy and to make their children happy. The self-fulfillment they get from a well-rounded life actually makes them more emotionally available for themselves, their children, and their husbands. All of this research has been around for decades. And so it's the Sunday before Mother's Day, and we have a week to anticipate the actual day. What can we say, what can I say to the mothers of young children in the church and elsewhere? First, thank you. Thank you, thank you. Motherhood is harder than I knew, harder than I think many of us know. And because we live in the only industrialized country without national maternity benefits, paid leave, or a coherent daycare policy, the weight of raising children falls on parents and especially on mothers. So thank you. And about the guilt. The guilt that follows you like a buzzard because there's too much to do. You can't do it perfectly. The guilt that's always with you, either in the foreground or in the back of your mind. My God, you're forgiven. Don't accept the guilt. Every mother I know is doing about all she knows how to do, and that's enough. That's really enough. You're being treated like the scapegoats of a society that will not put its money where its mouth is. A society whose behavior and economic priorities show how brutally and completely it ignores the services needed to support a healthy and happy family life in our country. And so all the failings are often dumped on you, and they can drive you crazy. Don't let them. You're doing the best you can, and that's enough. For God's sakes, you're forgiven. Now we have 1 week in which to anticipate Mother's Day. A week to consider the high costs of living in this only industrialized country. And a week to consider what gifts we might want to offer to our mothers, to our friends with children, and to the economic priorities of a greedy country. So much to think about. So many mothers who could use a gift. So much time. In the meantime, and in anticipation of that time, Happy Mother's Day.